Gentlemen, the first case for oral argument this morning is Curia v. Nelson. Mr. Weltman.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Stuart Weltman, and I am the attorney for Kenneth Nelson, the appellant in this matter. This matter is on appeal from an order of specific performance entered against my client, specifically ordering him to sell and transfer his majority shareholder interest in a corporation. The lower court entered Rule 54B findings, and this matter is on appeal pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1291. Without going into great details with respect to the particular agreements, as I assume Your Honors know, the order was predicated upon the enforcement of two options that were contained in a 1989 shareholder purchase agreement. Simply stated, it is our position that the lower court should be reversed for two separate grounds. The first, that being that the 1989 option provisions were no longer operative in March 2005 when the appellee Richard Curia attempted to exercise them. And then the second basis is, even assuming that the options were operative in 2005, that the exercise notices contained material non-conforming demands and conditions, or at least sought to impose them through the exercise notices upon my client, and my client rightfully rejected them because they constituted counteroffers.
I have a question about the 1993 document. Why would it include a mechanism for determining the share's purchase price if Curia no longer had the right to purchase the shares?
Well, Your Honor, that is the question, I guess, that was raised by the lower court.
Right.
And I don't think that if you take a look at the two sentences in paragraph 5 of the 1993 modification, my response would be to take a look first at the first sentence. And while the first sentence clearly puts Mr. Nelson in the driver's seat in that regard, in terms of whether or not there would be a subsequent purchase transaction of additional shares, there is a right of reasonableness in terms of how to go about that, so that there is a formula there at the end that, if they did agree to terms and conditions, would be the formula that they agreed to follow. I guess the point being is we could probably argue the niceties of these documents, and frankly, if all of us had been there drafting them earlier with 20/20 hindsight, we might have done it a little differently. But to me, the real question centers on the first sentence in paragraph 5, because what happens after that, in terms of the price, I think they, if one can put themselves in their shoes at the time, and again, these are negotiations and compromises. The first sentence was there, which clearly eliminated the language. Clearly eliminates the operation of the options in the 1989 shareholders purchase agreement. So perhaps there was a compromise. Well, at least let's have this formula. I can't do anything other than read the documents, which obviously Your Honors also can only read the documents. But to me, you've hit upon, while we've made many arguments as to why the 1989 options were inoperative as of 2005, to me, when one looks at the record, it is clear that the primary and almost could be the only sole reason is that first sentence. Because it's hard to, at least from what I can see, conclude anything other than the parties had agreed that any future purchases of shares would be subsequently agreed to upon the terms and conditions that the parties chose to do at a later date.
Then you're not making any argument that the contract language is ambiguous and you want to have a trial on extrinsic evidence of the party's meaning. I did not understand you to be making that argument from your briefs. It seems to me both sides are arguing that this is unambiguous, but it means something different.
Well, I certainly anticipated Your Honor's question, if that's the point. As you may or may not know, I am a substitute counsel. I substituted in after the notices of appeal were filed. So I have the record here, a record which both sides have agreed that the language is unambiguous. And the court has so, lower court has so ruled. So I dealt with that record. But if you're asking me if I had a choice between an affirmance and a remand because the court in its plenary duty in a de novo review concluded that the language is ambiguous, yes, between an affirmance and getting a remand on an ambiguity issue, I think we could clearly prove up even with greater detail outside of the four corners of the agreement precisely why the language in the first sentence of paragraph 5 means what we contend it means.
Well, but you did put your finger on the problem that we would encounter with that sort of an argument at this juncture. I mean, we're not bound by what the district court did because we are reviewing de novo, but we are restricted by waiver rules and so forth based on what the parties argued. I mean, usually what we would expect to see in a case like this with a complex series of commercial transactions is, as a threshold argument, the parties arguing that the language is unambiguous and duking it out over what it means, but then as a backup argument that if there is ambiguity, we've got all this extrinsic evidence on the side that can prove our interpretation of the contract, but that isn't how this went.
No, it's not the way I wrote my brief, and I'll admit that, because we believe the language is unambiguous. Because I also was bound by the record, and so therefore if I were to argue to Your Honor or to the court that the contract language is ambiguous, I'm now arguing an argument. This becomes the metaphysics of appellate argument. I'm now subject to an argument that I raised something new on appeal that was waived in the lower court. So I guess to clarify what I said in response to Your Honor's question is, since I know it's your job to do it de novo, I would accept that. But I believe, and I was bound by the record below, both sides agreed it was unambiguous. The court agreed it was unambiguous. So I made what I believe are strong arguments as to why the language in the first sentence of paragraph 5 has to control over the 1989 options. I think the lower court acknowledged that it took him several years to get through these, but that he believed it was unambiguous. With respect to the first sentence in paragraph 5, I think there can be no doubt what it says. And then the question is, how does it impact when one incorporates it into the entire agreement? Because the 1993 modification then becomes part of the 1989 SPA.
Specifically, counsel, how do you think that first sentence does what you say it does?
I'm sorry?
How do you believe that first sentence in paragraph 5 does what you say it does?
Well, I'll walk Your Honor through how I think it does. First off, the heading of the paragraph is entitled Purchase of Additional Shares. If we look at the companion paragraph, paragraph 4 in the 1989 SBA, it said options to purchase additional shares. Then the language says Curia shall have the right to purchase additional shares of stock in said corporations upon those terms and conditions subsequently agreed upon by the parties. Now, there are several ways that one can try to construe this. The way we construe it, which we believe is the plain meaning, is that the parties were agreeing that from here to forward, any additional purchases of stock by Curia would be subsequently agreed to by the parties. Now, looking in the context of the agreement as a whole, I don't think there's any other meaning to be given to that sentence, because let's assume, just for argument purposes, that the 1989 options are still in existence, notwithstanding this language. As we've set forth in our brief, the 1989 options dealt with precisely dealt with the number of shares to be sold and purchased in each staged option. And the entire option scenario covered every share. So if that was still in existence, if those options were still in existence, what effect, if all, could sentence 1 in paragraph 5 have? It would have no meaning. It would be inoperative if any or all of the 1989 options were still in existence. So from our perspective, once you put that in the context of being the amending language, it has to, by its natural effect, eliminate the options altogether. And I think, as we pointed out, that sort of made sense when you, again, just look at the four corners of the agreements. The 1993 modification gave Mr. Curia a substantial bump in his percentage shareholder interest, well beyond the percentages that were contemplated under the 1989 SBA. At that point in time, when Mr. Curia had only paid in $200,000 in for his purchases, he should have had only a 24% interest in the companies under the very precisely wrought structured 1989 SBA transfer schema. But pursuant to the four corners of the 1993 modification, he received an additional 5,306 shares, which bumped his ownership interest up to 48%. And we submit to you that when you look at that, you can ask, why did they do it? We don't know why they bumped him up. We're bound by the four corners. But when you look inside the document and see that that, in fact, has happened, there's no way that the two options that we're talking about here, the second and third options, could be exercised under their very specific terms. So when you construe those two together, we submit that construing the documents as a whole, the first sentence in paragraph 5 makes complete sense.
Finish that, because I wanted to ask you something about the price calculation.
Okay, well, they bumped him up substantially, up to 48%, doubled what he was entitled to as of the $200,000 pay-in point. And so the first sentence clearly makes sense in the context, again, of the documents, that they were saying, okay, we gave you that. Mr. Nelson gave you that, so let's now, in the future, any future purchases will be dealt with by agreement of the parties, Your Honor.
Yeah. Concerning the price calculation, don't the agreements say the figures are to be based on those from monthly reports immediately prior to the date that the option to purchase is exercised? And doesn't that mean, then, the month before March 2005?
You're asking about my valuation date argument?
Right.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. The answer is no. Because if we're jumping ahead and assuming that the options were at least exercised, the question becomes, what date should they have been were they actually exercised? Well, there's no doubt that they cannot be deemed to have been properly exercised in March 2005, because by the lower court's own conduct, orders, admissions, whatever one wants to say, it took the court 2 years to clean out what we believe were fatally defective counter demands and offers. But notwithstanding that, to make March 2005 the valuation date is to assume that my client, Kenneth Nelson, had to accept the exercise notices as given to him. And that clearly was not the case. They had a lower than agreed to price per share offer. They tied the purchase of the Plaza shares with the purchase of other shares in which Mr. Curia was not entitled to. And furthermore, as was further explicated throughout the proceedings, he also, Mr. Curia, improperly demanded that my client sell him real estate, which was never covered by the 1989 SBA. So the answer to the question, under the 1989 SBA, I think what you have to read into that is the valuation date prior to the month prior to the proper exercise of the notices. I think that's the only way to reasonably read that language. And in this context, if we're going to allow the district court to clean up these exercises, the only date that it was properly exercised is when the district court entered its final order clearing up the problems in the notices to begin with.
Just as an aside, your interest claim, is that still pending in the district court?
The interest claim?
The interest.
Okay, in terms of a jurisdictional question?
Yes.
The interest claim is still pending. Again, that is something that I think was one of the ones that the court laid out as an outstanding issue. In terms of the jurisdictional question, if the court is concerned, there really is no overlap. There are no factual overlaps with respect to the interest claim. That is just a legal question which would be argued before the court. And obviously, I was not lower court counsel involved in making these determinations, but it appeared that the parties all agreed that that was completely separate, and the judge agreed and felt that it would be more efficient if we dealt with this core issue, which clearly is the core issue of the case.
What about the real estate claim?
I'm sorry?
The real estate claim, isn't that more bound up with the merits of what we have here?
Mr. Curia's real estate claim?
Right.
Well, he's not appealing the court's ruling regarding the denial of his right to purchase the real estate.
But for purposes of our jurisdiction, the claims are sufficiently distinct that we can go ahead and exercise jurisdiction over this?
You can certainly ask opposing counsel, but I think we're in agreement that those are non-overlapping claims by every stretch of the imagination. I see that I've incurred on my rebuttal time, but I'm not sure how much time I have left.
Whatever you ask for.
I asked for 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
And you do have 5 minutes, sir.
Okay.
As we speak.
I'm sorry?
That's the more fine. You talk, the
more you talk, the less time you have.
Let me get away from here.
Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Douglas Lee, and I represent Richard Curia in these appeals. We set forth in our brief the primary reasons why we believe Judge Reinhardt's rulings should be affirmed, and I'll do my best not to restate those here this morning. Instead, what I'd like to do with my time today is to respond to some of the arguments Mr. Weltman has made this morning and in his reply brief, and, of course, to answer any questions the court might have. One thing that didn't come up in Mr. Weltman's argument that I think is vitally important here is the existence and the purpose of the 2000 modification. And there's a lot of talk in the case about whether the option rights remained, about whether the 89 agreement has somehow been terminated. Again, we need to look at the 2000 modification, in which the parties said that the 2000 modification was not a new agreement, but rather was an amendment of the 89 agreement and the 93 modification. Now, the other part that's important to remember there is once we get past 1990, the only purpose of the 89 agreement is to set forth Mr. Curia's options. So when the parties say in 2000 that they're recognizing the continued viability and validity of the 89 agreement, they're also saying that they recognize the continued viability of Mr. Curia's purchase options. And so when we talk about precision and number of shares and all those issues, you know, we think that the intent of the parties has to control, and the intent of the parties was to allow Mr. Curia these two purchase options.
Why did the 2000 modification agreement not mention the 1997 transactions?
Well, I think as Judge Reinhardt concluded that the 97, what we call the Harkness agreements, basically dealt only with the Sterling Corporation Auto Mall and not with Auto Plaza. So we think
that... Right, but the 2000 amendment purports to deal with both.
Correct. Because maybe I didn't understand your first question then. Well, why didn't they mention...
There's a disconnect there.
Well, no, I think that... I'm sorry, I misunderstood your first question, Ryan. I think that the parties in 2000 realized that the 97 agreements had played out their course. And they had dealt with Mr. Harkness, and Mr. Harkness, that situation was resolved.
Right, but the district court held that the import of the 97 agreements for purposes of this litigation was to take Auto Mall out of the picture as far as the option agreements, essentially to terminate those or extinguish.
As to Auto Mall, yes.
As to Auto Mall. If that's so, then why did the 2000 amendment mention both corporations?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I don't know that there's a great answer. I mean, I think any review of the documents will show that, with the exception of the Harkness agreements, each successive document had less and less legal input. I think that's a fair reading of the documents, and why it didn't, we don't know. But we do know, I think, that in 2000, the parties were continuing to recognize at least Mr. Correa's option to purchase shares in Auto Plaza. Now, we maintain below that the parties intended the Auto Mall options to continue also. Judge Reinhart disagreed with that, and we're not appealing that finding.
It suggests that there's ambiguity in how these documents are to be interpreted, these various inconsistencies in the agreements.
Well, again, I understand why Your Honor feels that way. Again, Judge Reinhart found, we argued, Mr. Nelson argued, that the documents, in terms of the issues before the court, were unambiguous.
And nobody made any fallback arguments that, to the extent there's ambiguity here, let's have a trial on extrinsic evidence and here's what we would intend to show?
No. Other than as to the goodwill issue.
Okay. So we're basically stuck with that record. It's all or nothing.
You would say stuck. Being the appellee, we're pleased with the record.
Right. That's fair.
But then, if I could, I'd like to address Judge Williams' question about the language in the paragraph 5 of the 93 modification. We obviously believe that it can be read much differently and should be read much differently than Mr. Weltman suggests. I mean, as Judge Reinhart recognized, there are basically three concepts in those first two sentences in paragraph 5. The first concept is Mr. Correa's right to purchase additional shares, and that's the word the parties used was right. The second concept is the subsequent terms and conditions language that Mr. Nelson talks so much about. Then obviously the third concept is the second sentence, the formula for determining the purchase price. Now Mr. Correa reads the document so as to give meaning to all three of those concepts. He has the right to purchase the shares at the price set forth in the formula, and the parties have the subsequent opportunity to negotiate non-price terms and conditions. Now, we might wonder, well, what kind of non-price terms and conditions are we talking about? Fortunately, we don't have to wonder. We know, because after Judge Reinhart ordered that the parties, or that Mr. Nelson convey the shares to Mr. Correa, the parties negotiated non-price terms and conditions, and those are set forth in the appendix in the order of pages 5 through 7. Mr. Nelson, for example, said, well, I'm not going to sell my shares, I'm not going to convey my shares, unless I'm released from personal guarantees for Auto Plaza debt. He said, I'm not going to convey my shares unless Auto Plaza agrees to indemnify me for debts or obligations of the corporation. He said, I'm not going to sell my shares unless Auto Plaza gets off of my real estate, a material that Auto Plaza has stored there. And Mr. Correa similarly says, well, I'm not going to pay you for your shares unless you and your sons resign as officers and directors of the corporation. So those are the kinds of non-price terms and conditions we believe that the parties were talking about in 93. Now, contrast that reading with reading Mr. Weltman espouses, which reads out entirely of those first two sentences. The first concept, Mr. Correa's right, as he admits, Mr. Nelson's in the, quote, power seat, and has the sole discretion to determine whether he would ever sell any shares to Mr. Correa, and also reads out the purchase price formula. Now, Mr. Weltman says, well, those can be easily reconciled because if Mr. Nelson agrees to sell the shares, it will be at that price. Well, we submit that that's backwards. I think we all know that if the formula generated a price Mr. Nelson didn't like, he wouldn't agree to sell the shares. So under Mr. Nelson's reading, there's no ability Mr. Correa has to enforce his right to purchase or to enforce the formula. And we believe that reading doesn't give a meaning to those two important concepts. Now, I'd like to spend a little bit of time responding to the argument that the exercises were invalid. And the starting point there, of course, is, well, what did the parties' agreements require regarding the exercise? And I believe the documents are clear that, all Mr. Correa was required to do was give written notice of those exercises, and that's what he did. He wasn't required to give written notice plus a down payment, not written notice plus delivery of another document, simply written notice, which he did. And he therefore fully satisfied the strict compliance rule that, Mr. Nelson talks so much about. Now, Mr. Nelson complains that Mr. Correa filled his notices or his exercises with nonconforming demands, conditions, counteroffers. That's simply not true. Your Honors have before you in the record at several places the notices. And granted, Mr. Correa in the notices refers to Auto Mall, in both notices refers to real estate in the second one, but he doesn't do so in a, conditional way. He doesn't say, I'm exercising my option to purchase the shares in Auto Plaza on the condition that you also sell me shares in Auto Mall, or on the condition that you also sell me real estate, or on the condition that the purchase price be X. Instead, Mr. Correa says he's exercising his option, and this is language from both notices, for the consideration and upon the terms set forth in the stock purchase agreement and the modification agreement. So he's, in his notices, he's incorporating the terms of the agreements. He's not imposing any conditions. And, that's why we think that the issue is one, where a distinction needs to be made between the, creation, the formation of the contract, and the performance of the contract. And that's why we rely so heavily on the Farley case, in which the court very clearly said that the valid exercise of an option creates a contract. And the fact that that contract later requires construction doesn't somehow retroactively invalidate the exercise of the option. And what the court also goes on to talk about is, you look at where the deal is. And in this case, the party's deal was in the 89 agreement, the 93 modification, and the 2000 modification. The deal was not in the exercise. And, Mr. Correa, even had he wanted to, outside of imposing conditions, could not have changed the terms of the deal simply by language in the notice. Now, the Berkmeyer case we also cite stands for essentially the same proposition. In that case, the court said that when all that's required to exercise is, written notice, that as long as that notice does not impose conditions, that the exercise is valid, even if the notice contains language that varies from the language in the underlying agreements. And at worst, that's what we have here. If I could talk a little bit about the valuation date argument that, Judge Williams raised. And this is an argument that has somewhat morphed over time. The argument that's presently before this court, which is that a different valuation date should be selected, I submit was never raised in the district court. In the district court, the argument was the exercise was invalid, therefore the valuation date is incorrect. And, through this, the briefing primarily in this court, we've gone to, well, there should be a different valuation date selected. As Judge Williams mentioned, there is a pending interest claim. We believe that's important. The other important fact on, that issue is that the argument implies, at least, that Mr. Nelson was at all times ready, willing, and able to share or to sell the shares in Auto Plaza at the price of the in the 2000 formula if Mr. Correa would just get off this Auto Plaza or Auto Mall and real estate issue and the 93 modification formula issue. That's simply not the case. We're here today because Mr. Nelson continues to resist his obligation to sell the Auto Plaza shares. The second point on that is that Mr. Weltman talks about the need for the district court to clean up the exercises. Well, number one, that's not what the court did. The court construed the contracts. The court never purported to clean up any exercises. But take the semantics out of it. The court resolved the Auto Mall issue, resolved the formula issue, and basically deferred the real estate issue in February of 06. So to the extent the notices needed to be cleansed, they were cleansed in February 06. The intervening litigation was all as a result of Mr. Nelson's unsuccessful attempts to have the notices declared invalid, to force goodwill into the purchase price, and to obtain a stay of the closing pending this appeal. So any delay here is on Mr. Nelson's shoulders, not Mr. Krius. And then I want to respond to a point that Judge Sykes made, or a question you raised about the real estate. We believe, and I believe it's in the record at the order at page 4, that the real estate issue has not been decided. That remains pending before the district court. The court denied Mr. Krius' motion for summary judgment as to that issue, but the court has not ruled that Mr. Krius does not have the right to purchase the real estate. Again, I don't think that necessarily clouds the jurisdictional issue here, but I did want to make that clarification. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about goodwill. And maybe the court understands Mr. Nelson's argument at this point. I admit that I do not. He says at one point in his reply brief on page 18 that the question of whether goodwill was one of the assets to be included in the formula should, quote, be left to Plaza's CPAs. Within a few paragraphs, however, then Mr. Nelson says that Mr. Blaine, who's one of those CPAs, couldn't determine what the parties intended regarding goodwill because, quote, construction of the 2000 modification was a question of law for the court. So I'm not sure whether he believes it's a question for the court or a question for Mr. Blaine. Fortunately, I think for all of us, it doesn't matter because the answer is the same. If it's a question of law for the court, you have the analysis Judge Reinhard went through, that the parties never mentioned goodwill, that Judge Reinhard's focus on the use of the word immediately in the formula suggests goodwill wasn't intended. We have the history of the plus or minus language, which first shows up in the 97 agreements and talks about, and more precisely says plus or minus year-end adjustments, and we believe that's the concept to carry forward. And then, of course, we also have the parties' actions in which when Mr. Harkness's shares were repurchased pursuant to a very similar formula, goodwill was never calculated, determined, or paid.
What's the import of that plus or minus assets language then?
Well, and again, it's we don't have to guess, we know, because in this case, we determined the purchase price pursuant to the formula and, by agreement of the parties, made adjustments to that price for various items that were not included on the balance sheet. And those are things such as prepaid expenses. In this case, there was a credit for an Oldsmobile franchise. It's those kind of year-end adjustments that you make to the monthly operating reports based on tax items that typically don't get added or subtracted until the end of the year. Those are the kind of adjustments we believe were intended in that language.
Let me ask you a question. If the March 05 notice stated it was exercising the option to purchase shares only if the price was that set forth in the 1993 agreement, do you agree that would have been a counteroffer?
Yes.
And why isn't that the best reading of the March 2nd notice? Doesn't it say that it was exercising the options upon the terms set forth in the stock purchase agreement in the 1993 March statement?
Yes, but again, we submit, Your Honor, that when you invoke the terms and conditions, I mean, Judge Reinhard found that one of those terms and conditions was we need to go get the formula from the 2000 modification, that the 2000 modification is part of the party's underlying agreement. And again, Mr. Correa never said, I will purchase the shares only if it's a certain price. He said, I'll purchase the shares at the price determined by the party's agreements.
But the 2000 modification agreement set forth the terms and conditions between the parties in the event of Mr. Nelson's death.
Correct.
So why would that control the purchase price since he is still alive?
Well, again, we argued in the district court that the proper formula was the 93 formula that Mr. Correa cited in the exercises. Judge Reinhard found that, again, following the party, doing his best to determine the party's intent, that the party's intent was to use the formula in the 2000 modification. Again, we argued, just like you suggested, that, well, that's a different formula for a different context. Judge Reinhard found that, well, this is the latest formula, and this is what the party's intended to use on any purchase of shares.
So you're accepting that?
We've accepted that. Then one final point on goodwill, and that relates to what the accountants said. And the only time, and this is in the record, the only time Mr. Blaine ever computed the value of the shares pursuant to the formula, he did in a sample that he provided to the parties in terms of how the formula would work. When he did that, he didn't reference goodwill, didn't attempt to determine the value of goodwill, didn't say, and then we would add goodwill at the end of it. He just did it exactly pursuant to the terms in the formula. Of course, then we also have the accountant's testimony before the district court. Mr. Glau, which was Mr. Nelson's retained expert, testified he could not opine that the formula included goodwill. In fact, he said that his determination of goodwill was based on an entirely different valuation method that was wholly independent of the formula in any of the modifications. And then, of course, we have Mr. Blaine's testimony that he couldn't give an opinion that goodwill was to be included because it depended on the party's intent. And then, moreover, under the Moncrief case that we cite in our brief, we don't believe that there's any need for this court to wonder about what an evidentiary hearing would show on this issue, because given the somewhat unique posture of the case, we know that evidence is in the record, it was before the district court, and is before this court. And what it shows is there's simply no evidence that the parties intended to include goodwill in the purchase price formula, or that it should be included for any other reason. If there are no more questions, I simply ask the court, I respectfully request that the court affirm Judge Reinhardt's rulings.
Thank you.
How much time?
Yep, 4 minutes.
Thank you. First, addressing the interpretation of my opponent's interpretation of the first sentence of the fifth paragraph. Again, one can only read the sentence, and I'm going to read it again because if you read it in it just on its own, it clearly, in context, refers to any future rights, not any previous rights. And so from that position, just reading it on its own, it's clear that this is what the parties had agreed to do with respect to how shares are going to be transferred in the future. With respect to the valuation date, counsel noted that it wasn't argued in the court below. The simple response to that is that we're appealing from that order. The judge ruled against us and said that the options were operative and then chose a valuation date, which on appeal we contend is not in comport, does not comport with the party's agreement. But most importantly, I think we have to take a look, because I didn't get too much time, I didn't spend too much time on the option notices themselves. And I think it was Judge Williams who asked the question about whether demanding a lower price was a counteroffer. But that's not the only demand. And if one takes a look at the specific language in the option exercise, particularly, let's say, the March 3rd, which is the last one, this is not a statement, as counsel says, of what they thought the terms and conditions of the parties' agreements were. This was a demand that you close within 60 days upon the terms and conditions that we've set forth in this exercise letter. And those conditions included not only demanding a lower price, which now has been judicially admitted because Curia in the lower court agreed with the court's ruling that the formula under the 2000 modification was the operative formula, and that this demand in the March 3rd exercise also demands that Nelson sell Curia his shares in Mall when the court clearly ordered that was no longer on the table and not a proper demand. And you can't separate those from each other just because of the fact that you want to. This was a combined demand. It demanded the Plaza shares and it demanded the Mall shares. And finally, demanding that Nelson sell real estate, which was never covered by the party's 1989 option agreement to begin with. Any one of those should result in a finding that this was a non-acceptance counteroffer and an ineffective exercise. The combination of the three makes it clearly fatal for purposes of exercising the options. With that said, Your Honor, we would ask the court obviously reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.